the other neoliberalism, German Oldenburgism after the Euro crisis. My name is Michelle Binelli, and I'm a fellow in political theory in the Department of Government here at the LSE. So I guess the occasion for this event tonight is the recent publication of a book titled Ordoliberalism, Law and Rule of Economics. The book, as I said, has recently been released by Hart Publishing. It is edited by Josef Ehn and Christian Borges. And our four speakers tonight, they have all contributed to the book, and I guess that their presentations tonight will somehow relate to the content of the book. The structure of the event is going to be that each of the four speakers will have 10 minutes and will give us an overview of the contribution to the book. And then we will have time for the Q&A. But before we start, let me say a few words about the event and about the speakers. So the event is co-organized by the Department of Government and by the European Institute here at the LSE. If you want to tweet about the event, the hashtag is LSE Ordoliberalism. And the first speaker for tonight is going to be David Wooldorf, who's associate professor, in the Department of Government here at the LSE. He teaches comparative politics and he specializes on Russian and Soviet political economy. After him, we're going to have Albert Wheels, who's emeritus professor in political theory and public policy at the University College London, and who has written widely on European policy theory. The third speaker is going to be Michel Everson, who's professor of law at Birkbeck and Birkbeck University, part of the University of London, and has written widely on European constitutional law as well as economic law. And then our last speaker is going to be Professor Jonathan White from the European Institute here at the London School of Economics, who is expert in political theory as well as in European politics. So without further ado, I'll leave the floor to David, and yes, and then we'll go on the other speakers.
Thank you very much, Lucia, and thanks to all of you for coming. I will now try to convince the machine to show you my presentation, which I hope will work. Indeed, it has. Excellent. I was introduced as a specialist in Russian and Soviet political economy. In fact, some years ago, I decided it was altogether too depressing to study Russian political economy, and so I don't do that very much anymore. And these days, the level of depressing I can do is German economic policy. And for that, I wanted to learn something about order liberalism. That's how I got interested in that topic. What I'm going to try to do today is give you a really, really quick introduction to what order liberalism is through the lens of a comparison with the well-known political economist Karl Polanyi. And I'll talk a little bit about the thesis of my contribution to the book as time permits. So, who are the order liberals? Here are four of the key thinkers. Basically, the order liberals were a school of German thought that emerged in the interwar years and became more influential in the post-war years, trying to think about what could liberalism be after it seemed to be clearly failing in the interwar years, both politically failing and failing economically as policy moved away from laissez-faire and in a more étatiste direction. And so they posed themselves two questions. Why was it that classical or laissez-faire liberalism failed? And how could one construct a neo-liberalism that would be protected from a similar failure? And in this, they were quite similar to Karl Polanyi, who was an Austro-Hungarian itinerant political economist and teacher, who also posed this question of why it was that classical laissez-faire liberalism failed. And furthermore, All right. Okay, Excellent. So Polanyi had also tried to figure out why it was that liberalism had failed, and what he tried to figure out what would come next, because he thought that it wasn't salvageable. So if we look at what Polanyi argued, Polanyi is famous for arguing that laissez-faire was planned. What he means by this is the key elements of market liberalism, the gold standard, a free labor market, free trade, a labor market in particular that didn't have protection for people who couldn't find work. Those things were put together deliberately in the first third of the 19th century in this country with the idea of creating an economic system that would function automatically, much like the balance between predators and prey does in an ecosystem. So he thought that laissez-faire was planned, but planning, which he's using, kind of mocking the liberals' polemical use of planning to refer to anything that isn't laissez-faire, planning, he says, was not. The consequences of laissez-faire for Polanyi were so obviously devastating that reactions that restricted the operation of the price mechanism with respect to land, labor, and money were all but inevitable. So you get this spontaneous counter-movement or a self-defense of society that tries to limit the operation of this price mechanism that had been deliberately implanted. Once, on Polanyi's argument, once one starts to interfere with the price mechanism, not let the price of labor adjust in line with the dictates of the gold standard, for instance, you get a market society that refuses to function. This leads, in his analysis, to fascism after authoritarian efforts to make market liberalism function, and or a very broadly understood socialism. He has in mind the New Deal in the United States, so it's fairly, very broadly understood when the gold standard is understood, abandoned early. So Polanyi, laissez-faire is planned, market liberalism is planned, you get this necessary spontaneous reaction to it, and that leads to either fascism or socialism, depending on what happens with the gold standard. Now, order liberals were more or less analyzing the same history, but they were doing it through a different lens. They agreed that laissez-faire was planned. And I think that if you're trying to compare the order liberals to other neoliberals, this is a very important point. The order liberals accept that the state has a crucial role to play in any market economy. Other neoliberals also accept that, but they have a much more, they have a bad conscience, if you will, about it. It's very hard for them to talk about it. Ordo liberals can say, yes, we need a state to make the market society function. So they don't, and they believe that laissez-faire was planned, not animated by these kind of ecological metaphors, but rather by Smithian ideas about how God had set us all up so that a market economy was the right way for us to organize things. However, the liberals also see, like Polanyi, that laissez-faire gave rise to a counter-movement. They don't see this as self-protection of society. They see this as people who can't hack it in market competition, interfering and restricting market competition, and making things function worse. So laissez-faire proved ideologically undefended against these efforts of what are these days called rent-seekers to undermine competition, because Smith didn't plan laissez-faire well enough to account for this tendency of people to seek over-competitive returns. He thought that God had set us up, that markets would work, so he didn't think enough about that. So this is a key element of the order liberal critique of Smith. And they also feel like laissez-faire relied on rule of law just functioning without being defended from interest groups. So you get then the interwar economic disruptions once you get the interference with the price mechanism. So we can see that Polanyi and the order liberals have a very different picture of what happened in the history from about 1830 to about 1930. Start with laissez-faire, you get social resistance to the price mechanism, conceived differently, but same processes and eventually the breakdown of markets and a socio-political catastrophe leading to the destruction of freedom. Now, distinct solutions, they propose distinct solutions to this. I'm keeping close track of time, and I think I have about 2 minutes left. For Polanyi, the problem was laissez-faire. Laissez-faire was the original sin. It was a stark utopia. It was never going to work. The ordo-liberals say, let's not get rid of laissez-faire. Let's see what we can do about this social resistance to the price mechanism. How can we deal with that? And what they try to do is they try to limit, if you will, the supply of anti-competitive policies, the ability of the state to shape markets in anti-competitive ways by constitutionally constraining the state, by making sure that all regulations have a general form, number of ways that they try to constrain the state. They also try to reduce the demand for anti-competitive policies by diffusing the capacity for competition through society. Now, if you look at what accounts for this distinction, so this, what I have here in blue, that's really the core set of ideas of order liberalism. If you want to understand, you know, if you need a cocktail napkin kind of version of order liberalism, that's what it is. I know everybody needs one of those. Okay, so in the final minute, I'll try to talk about what accounts for the distinction. And basically, I think the key issue is that Polanyi thought that markets always were based on compulsion. The order liberals thought that markets could be based on free exchange. And therefore, they thought it was possible to come up with what I call a theodicy of markets, an account of why markets allocate rewards to people that deserve them. And if you look at what they argue, over and over again, it seems like the order liberals are striving for a morally appropriate market order. And what they mean by a morally appropriate market order is one that allocates rewards in line with desert. So if you are interested in order liberalism and you want to read my article, what you will find is an account of how the order liberals constructed this moral order. But I'm not going to try to do that here so that my colleagues can have some time to talk. I hope what I've done is communicate to you that order liberalism's foundational idea was, okay, laissez-faire was planned, but it was planned badly. How can we replan it? How can we re-engineer our society such that a competitive market order can sustain itself? Okay, thank you.
So thank you very much for the invitation. I think, like David, I first became interested in ordo-liberalism because I was really interested in what was going on in the discussion about Eurozone crisis, European political economy, and so on. My contribution to the book actually hits on something that I think is a particular moment in the development of ordo-liberal thinking, because if you think about the discussions about European political economy between the Keynesians on the one side and the ordo-liberals on the other, it is as though they were living in two parallel universes. And I've chosen a particular point where the parallel lines seem to meet. Here's an illustration. This is from Joseph Stiglitz's book, The Euro and Its Threat to the Future of Europe. The Germans have emphasized the need for all the countries of Europe to follow the rules. Germany's stance is predicated on the belief that profligate government spending leads to crises. That is simply wrong. Jens Weidmann, living embodiment of ordo-liberal thinking, Bundesbank president. This is his speech when accepting the Wolfram Engels Prize. Just as a market economy can only function if enterprises take responsibility for the consequences of their decisions, so a currency union with sovereign states can only function if states and banks carry responsibility themselves for their decisions. Parallel universes. I'm very pleased to be giving this talk at the LSE because a good way, I think, into thinking and getting to know the history of ordoliberalism is Walter Eucken's book, This Unsuccessful Age, which was a series of lectures given at the LSE. Unfortunately, I never lived to see them published, but they're, I think, a very good introduction. By the way, we shouldn't. I should pay credit to Walter Eucken. He's a very courageous man. For example, it was Eucken at Freiburg who led the opposition to Heidegger's attempt, that rogue Heidegger, who tried to Nazify the university system, and Eucken led the opposition to him. But in this book, there's a very interesting introduction by John Jukes, who at that time had been a young Keynesian working in the Cabinet Office. And it's the intersection of the ideas in that introduction and in Eucken's lectures that I want to present to you very quickly today. So there they are. There's Eucken on the one side and Jukes with the spectacles on the other. Jukes himself was an interesting man, but we can maybe go into that into the discussion. So in order to understand Eucken's thought, and Eucken is an important strand of ordoliberalism, you need to understand something about his general methodology of economics. If you read an Eucken text, you will see no simultaneous equations, you will see no rational choice modelling, you will see no econometric estimations. He works on the principle that when you're studying an economic system, you're studying a particular type of economic and social order. You're studying patterns of relationship among firms, consumers, workers, and so on, that are governed by certain principles. For example, a principle of competition, or a principle of monopoly, or a principle of oligopoly, and so on. And an order is not a succession of different historical forms, village economy, city economy, and so on. It's the way in which these different types of interaction in an economic and social order relate to one another, how those everyday processes are controlled. And they're constantly changing. So one of the reasons why those series of lectures are interesting that he gave is that he takes the economic history of Germany from the 19th century onwards, which he sees as actually exhibiting different types of order. Cartelization at the end of the 19th century, the social democratic experiments in the 1920s, the national socialist experiments in the 1930s, and so on. And the policy task, as Eucken sees it, is to find an order. Right, so order is an analytical category, but the policy task is to find a liberal order, which, as he puts it, is functionally efficient and worthy of humanity, funktionsfähig und menschenwürdig. Now, Eucken had some interesting things to say about why he wasn't a Keynesian. He'd read Keynes very early, long before he gave these lectures. And here is, in brief, his argument. He says, when people are unemployed, they're still working, but they're not working as productively as they might do. So, for example, they may be growing vegetables in their own garden, but they could be carrying on some much more productive activity. So the problem is to enable people to be their most productive. And that requires, and this is the crucial step in the argument, that requires resources to be allocated in line with the marginal cost principle, right, that you pay for the marginal cost of the production of a unit in the economy, and this is crucial, that prices are allowed to respond to changes in the condition under which resources are produced. So his fundamental criticism, for example, of National Socialist planning in the 1930s is that it created what he called administratively controlled suppression of inflation, an attempt to change, to suppress relative price changes. And that was the way in which you got distortions into the economy. And it was also, if you could get those distortions out of the economy, you could also solve the social question. Now, Jukes, who was a liberal in many respects, although he was a Keynesian at the time, was critical in his introduction to these lectures of Eucken's lack of concern with Keynesian demand management. And he writes that the English liberal economists have become convinced that the state has a useful function to perform in the prevention of unemployment by accepting ideas and adopting methods, deficit financing, which would go beyond those heretofore accepted as constituting the proper role of government. He says it's very difficult to take for granted the thought that when competition is restored and money sound, that full employment can be taken for granted. Very interesting list of the conditions that he thinks would need to be satisfied in order for non-inflationary Keynesian demand boosts to work. Governments with strong liberal instincts, conscious of the evils of open inflation, and so on. Very long list of conditions. I'm going to just pick out two very interesting remarks he makes. Trade unions that recognise that caution in pressing for wage increases in a position of full employment technique is just as essential a part of the use of the full employment technique as is the adoption of non-conducting devices in the use of electricity. Wonderful analogy, I think. And he goes on to say that the average citizen shows in economic matters the kind of common sense and communal wisdom revealed in the workings of any mature democracy. And he goes on to say, look, you may think that's impossible, but there's a sort of paean of praise to Stafford Cripps in the 1940s, Labour government, and the willingness of the trade unions. Now, Eucken's had a reply to this. He couldn't actually reply to Jukes. Unfortunately, he died. But in the Grundsätze der Wirtschaftspolitik, his systematic treatise, unfortunately, I think it's still not been translated. I mean, there's some talk about it being translated, but
it's a bit hard.
Okay. I think it's a pity that it's not been translated. But in that, he has a discussion of Keynesianism. This is in the 1930s. He says that credit expansion can distort relative prices. Remember what I was saying about the importance of allowing prices to reflect marginal costs. And that when pricing is distorted, then the plans of individual consumers and of central plans are just not coordinated. Only the price mechanism can value resources at their marginal cost. And what he calls Keynes's corporatism led to self-interested lobby. This was the point that David was making. Now, there's a sort of myth that goes around in some circles about the influence of auto-liberalism in Germany. By the way, this conference from which this book emerged was called Auto-Liberalism, Irritating German Idea. But those were not irritated by it. They have this sort of following period of praise, and it runs as follows. Auto-liberalism influenced Erhard's policies in the post-war period, who lifted price controls and created sound market. That was the base of the social market economy. Social market economy has been a great success. Therefore, it was the implementation of auto-liberal policies that's been the key to success. Well, as always, I'm afraid the truth is a bit more complicated than that. I won't go into the details, but the historical record just doesn't support that interpretation. What I think supports, what is crucial, I think, to the success of the auto-liberal and social market reforms was the role of the trade unions in wage restraint. There's quite a lot of historical evidence on this. Remember what Jukes said, that trade unions recognise that caution in pressing for wages is just as essential a part of the full employment technique as the adoption of non-conducting devices in the use of electricity. Now, the point about this is that on auto-liberal assumptions, that ought not to be true, because the trade unions are corporatist enterprise, and they're the problem, they're not the solution. But actually, if you look at the historical record, from the auto-liberal point of view, looks as though it's going to be the problem, actually turns out to be part of the solution, wage restraint. By the way, some of you who follow the German economy may have noticed that the great trade union IG Metall, leader of the working class movement, has fulfilled its historic function in recent weeks and just got 4% and increased parental leave for its workers, so they're beginning to fight back. That is really a sort of variety of capitalism's argument. This is a claim I make in the chapter. I think that's a rather pessimistic lesson, actually, at the European level, because at the European level, you don't have that sort of embedded set of economic and social relations on which you can rely in order to get that restraint in the way in which economic actors interact with one another. You can't have the common sense of a mature democracy at the European level, and if you can't have that, then auto-liberal prescriptions have limited viability at that level. But that's what we're stuck with. Thank you very much.
Change the glasses. So, as I find my... I have to... I'm at that age, I'm afraid. I have to change the glasses to be able to work the computer. Audio liberal lessons. I think this is me. This is me. Yep. I must admit being quite surprised to be in this book. Certainly at the time of the conference, I'd have said, what do I know about ordo liberalism? I know a lot more since then, since I've actually been translating for the Normative Orders Project in Frankfurt, some of the key ordo liberal texts. So now I know an awful lot more. As I approached it, certainly for the conference and in the chapter, what interests me about ordo-liberalism, obviously I'm a lawyer, I'm an economic lawyer, and the ordo-liberals are so terribly relevant to us because they are the bridge between law and economics. And that is something, and there were lawyers involved, so it's not law and economics. It is a methodological bridge between the two. And this is what makes them so powerful to us as lawyers. And my interest in them has always been their relevance for what is happening around us, certainly within the European context. So my chapter in the book really does deal ultimately with the Brexit, the disintegration of Europe, and whether the ordo-liberal prescriptions would have any lessons that might help develop Europe in the future, might actually act as a counterweight to the problems that Europe is experiencing. I'm not going to talk actually about that part of my relationship with ordo-liberalism today. I thought I'd look, what are the lessons of ordo-liberalism for us now with regard to ultimately a crisis, I think a crisis in liberalism, full stop, that we are experiencing now. Albert has alluded to the fact that the ordo-liberals were very brave. Eucken, they were all very brave. Boehm, writing during the period of fascism, was also writing a critique of fascism. And it's certainly when you start translating the text and you actually get really close to the intricacies of what they're writing and how careful they were to give that message in a way that could be defended in the midst of the regime. So they are more than just liberals supporting liberalism in a normal context. They are liberals defending liberalism against the collapse, not just of the state, but of all human decency and humanity. Yeah? So they are, in a certain sense, they are absolute heroes. And again, we need then to think today, or I feel we need to think and look at them today and think, can they tell us anything about our current problems? If you are reading the European literatures, certainly around Greece, there is a suggestion that the ordo-liberals are in fact responsible for the collapse of Europe, the ordo-liberal nightmare, the fact that conditionalities, economic conditionalities are being imposed on southern European states, that it is the ordo-liberal obsession with price stability, maintaining the currency, that is causing these problems. One might have some feeling that perhaps they have contributed. Here I have a quote from Boehm, from the ordo-liberal manifesto, where you see there is certainly a belief in price stability to the degree that it maintains the price mechanism. So maybe there is an ordo-liberal problem. However, I do wonder if there isn't, using the ordo-liberals now, if there isn't more of an ordo-liberal opportunity. Yeah, I'm not an ordo-liberal. I lean to the left, but still I look to the ordo-liberals because they tell us some real things about what is going on now. It is not a pleasant time of history, and certainly if you look around you, certainly find yourself a touch trapped between Trump man and Davos man at the moment. We have two versions. Oops, I've lost my, yeah. We have two versions of relationships with markets, and I've given you Witherspoon rather than Trump himself, the Trump relationship with markets, and then we have the Davos man relationship with markets. Are these the only possible forms of markets, of liberalism? What do the ordo-liberals tell us about them? To repeat what has already ultimately been said by the two previous speakers, but to put it in a slightly more immediate context, Franz Boehm, the order is the translation of Hayek's market democracy, ultimately. This is what is going on with the order that grounds the economy. It is quite inspirational to the extent that the order liberals are telling us that the market is not free. The market is not free. The notion of Trump man, the Brexiteers, who are ultimately quite happy to break down the rule of law, their freedom is the freedom of power. The ordo notion is no, the market is not free. Yes? To be a market, it needs to be constrained and it needs to be contained within hypotheticals. This ultimately is the complaint of Boehm against what is happening around him in the 1930s. This is naked power being exercised in a way that pulls the market out of its hypotheticals, that destroys freedom. It may not be true economically, but it is a vision. We have that strong normative underlying basis that also alerts us to the dangers of Trump man. Yep. I put in a quote from Oikum because I am actually a bit, the market is also human. This seems to me, I picked it up from the Grundrisse, and it seems to me to actually, a little bit against the idea that the Aldos were actually wholly concerned with price stability. In a certain sense, these are the preconditions. Yeah. The market, their order, exists in a web of human relationships, including currency, including labour relations. I've just stuck it in. It's not so particularly relevant here, but it's interesting. Moving on to the market is very human. What about Trump? What about Davos man? What would the ordo liberals say about Davos man? I've picked up here, I don't Messmecker. Ultimately, this is a quote on the law and economics movement, that it is ideology in the service of unlimited government and socialism, the refutation of a concept of justice ignoring viable negative tests of justice that identify unjust norms. In a certain sense, within the ordo-liberal movement, we also, it's again a rejection of the idea that the economy is a material reality. This is again the core. For Davos man, the economy can be controlled, it can be financialized, it can be rationalized, it can be optimized. Market justice, there is a universal material market justice out there if only we can get the science right, the science that reflects the materiality of human relations. In Hayek's words, scientism, a chimera. This is socialism, yes? Socialism, again, because it creates an idea that there is a reality of economic truth out there. And this, again, Messmecker, he's not actually criticising Davos man directly, he's criticising the law and economics movement. No. This is the hubris. This is the idea that you can control markets, and this is where liberality fails. So, for today, and again with the caveat that I'm not an ordo-liberal, what I would say is so interesting for us now is exactly that underlying normative mission that also sheds some light on the two competing problems of our age, which is why they're still worth reading. And I'll stop there too.
Okay, so hello, I'm Jonathan White. I came at this topic, I guess, with an interest in ordo-liberal theory as a political theory and an interest in its political implications. I think it's probably fair to say that before this project I was very much the embodiment of Anglo-Saxon ignorance about ordo-liberalism as a tradition, and perhaps haven't entirely shaken off that persona, but I got interested in one particular aspect, especially of ordo-liberalism, which was its implications for how we're thinking about political institutions, political agency. And I think central in this respect is the quintessential ordo-liberal idea of the economic constitution. I think if there's one concept which really does stand out as ordo-liberal and not to be mixed up with laissez-faire economics or Chicago School neoliberalism, it's very much this idea of an economic constitution, a framework of rules, I guess, constraining the exercise of political agency, whether by executive power or by legislative power. And it seems to me that this is very much the heart of anything that we might want to use the term ordo-liberal to describe. A political vision which is not just about constraining executive and legislative power in a process sense. Of course, political constitution is an idea shared across the Western tradition, we could probably say, but an economic constitution is something that actually embeds certain policies as to be protected from the whims of political agency. So when I started reading ordo-liberal texts, things like Boehm, as mentioned, Eucken, the kind of phrases that that struck me were very much those that touched on this idea of constraint, of reining in the discretionary power of institutions, automatically functioning coordination system, an aim to restrict the state to the task of defining the structural framework, and of course not engaging in economic policy making in a more substantive sense, but shaping a framework and then restricting itself. Boehm talks about very much the goal as being to severely limit political discretion. So this discourse of rules that we tend to associate with ordo-liberalism when we come at it through Eurocrisis contemporary events, I think is very much in some of these founding texts. Walter Eucken talks about an ideal of rational automatism. So again, a sense of a political order in which the constraint of discretion of political power is very important. I think you can trace that in different directions. I think it's partly about a technocratic, and we heard, I think, already the notion that ordo-liberalism is very much a tradition of a scientific understanding of policy making. So it's partly about a concern for the coherence of policy, familiar ideas perhaps to us today, that one doesn't want chopping and changing policies insofar as this can undermine the logic, the coherence of the policy regimes arising. Partly also, of course, a major ordo-liberal theme, fear of state capture, the state as ideally something which is irreducible to the socio-economic interests of particular actors, the desire to separate political authority from capture by private interests. That, again, I think, as a different source of inspiration for this interest in constraining political agency with rules. Of course, it's not a theory that has no space for decision. It's all about, at one level, a landmark decision that is taken in favour of the market economy. Gesamtentscheidung, I think, is the term that they are using. But if you like, that moment of agency is in the past once one has gone down the ordo-liberal track. It is something which, once one takes a decision in favour of a certain model, is supposed to be decontested, and then political agency is not about revisiting those types of questions. So what does this sensibility, a concern for stable rule-based policy regimes, imply in moments of economic stress? This was what the angle that I was coming at these texts from, writing as someone interested in contemporary politics and in questions of crisis. I talk about sensibility there. Of course, there is a large scholarship out there at the moment on, can one read events as though they were almost following a recipe book of ordoliberalism? Can one proceed from ordoliberal texts to policies in a causal fashion? And when I talk about sensibility for the constraint of political authority, for rules and so on, I want to suggest a slightly looser connection between traditions and policies. There is, I think, fair to say, an influence on political culture, both in Germany and perhaps more broadly in contemporary Europe, which takes up this aversion to the exercise of political discretion, but a sensibility rather than simply the enactment of founding texts. And so I was interested in what, if one has that sensibility, what are the logical possibilities available to you for thinking about responses in moments of economic crisis, times of particular challenge to order, to the existing policy regimes as they've been inherited? And some of the possibilities that I try to trace out in my chapter, well, there is empty way. How does an order liberal come to terms with the need for discretion? Clearly, one response, if you have a sensibility that is averse to the exercise of political agency at something later than a founding constitutional moment, the moment of the creation of an economic constitution, clearly one response is to try and stick by whatever rules framework one inherits in the moment of crisis. In other words, to try and prop up, if you like, what one has. But of course, there may be many reasons why that is either unworkable or indeed undesirable for reasons internal to ordoliberalism. So, as we've heard already, ordoliberalism, of course, it's just not an economic theory only. It's a moral theory. It's a theory about just deserts and so on. So for reasons internal to ordoliberalism, there may be good reasons not to want to, in moments of stress, simply uphold the existing framework. Well, it seems to me then that other logical possibilities available in those contexts are to actually make recourse to executive discretion, in other words, to depart from a strong emphasis on rules, constraints on discretion and so on, but to do so with a very strong emphasis on how this is being done under the pressure of necessity. In other words, to act in discretionary terms, but to do so emphasizing that there are circumstances that demand a certain response. Could therefore be in the form of an exception to a framework, and I think one can obviously look at euro crisis measures, exceptional credit facilities, as, if you like, the logic of exception from an existing rules framework. Or it can be about new beginnings. One can say that an existing framework is radically incomplete in some fashion, and therefore the act of discretion is not simply exceptional, it's foundational. It's about almost saying that there is no economic constitution currently in existence. We are at that moment of decision where we start and introduce what doesn't currently exist in any genuine sense. And clearly one can think about things like the fiscal compact and so on as things that actually go much further than simply exceptional measures, but are almost understood, well, either as completions, but radical completions of things radically incomplete, like the Stability and Growth Pact, or, if you like, somehow new beginnings. But because both of these types of embraces of executive discretion are, I think, a concession of sorts for those who are of the order liberal sensibility, who are generally averse to these types of strong departure from an existing rules framework, then they're a kind of concession, and therefore it seems to me that they invite casting circumstances as exceptional and determining, because anything less would not validate the discretion exercised. So what can we take from this? Well, I suggest two things, one to do with the structure of order liberalism and one to do with the wider contemporary political scene and what we might say as responses to some of these commitments. Well, on the first, to do with the implications for order liberalism, well, it seems to me, and again, clearly we can make all manner of distinctions between actually existing order liberalism and the coherence of ideas themselves, but it seems to me that there's perhaps an interesting affinity between, on the one hand, a sensibility for binding rules, for frameworks which are not to be meddled with after a moment of foundational decision, and what is their apparent opposite, a kind of politics of emergency, of exactly discretionarily intervening with existing frameworks, either with the logic of exception or the logic of new beginnings. Precisely because the bar for political discretion is set so high, to employ discretion requires ramping up the situation as one of gravity and urgency, framing situations in ways that do not suggest competing value choices, but a dichotomy of order and disorder. So it seems to me that a combination of rules and extraordinary discretion is perhaps even characteristic of order liberalism and currents of thought that have a strong emphasis on the constraint of executive and legislative discretion. Possibly this helps us understand things in the euro crisis. Perhaps we can even say that big reforms taken in the last 8 years in the European Union context relied on a context of emergency for these reasons, precisely because, again, for those with a sensibility for these types of constraints on discretion, then it is only in contexts of high emergency that one can make major changes to an existing inherited regime. You might even see this as a kind of order liberal, a distinctively order liberal contribution to a shock doctrine. But then a second point to do with things beyond ordo liberalism and contemporary events. Well, it seems to me, based on what I've been saying, one might say that order liberalism, but also many other neoliberalisms, Chicago school liberalism as well, is a rejection of political agency, perhaps a rejection twice over. On the one hand, by insisting that decisions should generally follow a pre-established script, in other words, everything that I've been saying about an economic constitution, a set of constraints that are substantive and not merely processual on the exercise of authority, but also, in a second sense, when some type of major discretion does have to be exercised, it has to be perhaps premised on an idea of necessity, urgency, and so on. These are the thresholds that one has to cross given those prior sensibilities. Now, it seems to me that possibly this is one way of understanding the appeal of what often tends to be called populism in the contemporary world. I would suggest that we might think of many of the political movements that tend to be described in these terms exactly as a repudiation of ideas of necessity, of constraints on agency. They are, if you like, celebrations of departing from scripts, departing from inherited rules, frameworks. Of course, a lot of the scholarship on populism tends to emphasize other things, and I think this is some of the limitations both of the concept and the way it tends to be analyzed. If you read the political science of populism, it tends to emphasize many other things to do with anti-elitism, and insistence on the category of the people as a mobilizatory resource, anti-pluralism, a notion of the good of the people as somehow incontestable. I think these are all entirely valid observations, but it seems to me that they still leave open the question, if these are the ways that one wants to define something called populism, are they necessarily the source, the motivational source of the appeal of those movements and parties that go by the description of populism? Valorizations of the people, anti-pluralism and so on, those all may be characteristic, but are they exactly the key aspect of what's in play? And I would say that exactly this promise of agency, of departing from scripts, is at the heart of the appeal of movements that are often categorized as populist. It's not conceptually distinctive to populism. Of course, any kind of democratic ideology to some degree invokes ideas of will, of discretion, of what I describe elsewhere, a politics of volition, as opposed to a politics of necessity. These are not things distinctive to populism, but they arguably become the source of appeal for movements and parties within a wider context of the disavowal of political agency. Order liberalism is only part of that story, but I think other economic doctrines of the present also can be read as prioritizing necessity over volition. So this then is my final thought. Perhaps the best way to understand certain contemporary political phenomena, like what we call populism, is the very reverse of this kind of ordo-liberal sensibility, and also how other neoliberalisms define the role of political authority as something to be constrained, as something for which discretion is the greatest problem, and which the framework is all about constraining. There's an interesting, I think, mirror image, possibly also a causal relation between the two. I'll stop there.
Maybe the person, when you ask the question, if you can introduce yourself and say who are you addressing the question to. Yes,
please. My name is question
You were quite dismissive of the relationship between Erhard and the revival of the post-war German economy. I mean, a lot of the literature in the Ordo Jahr book specifically looks at his abolition of price controls, specifically against the advice of the Allies. And then the effect within about 6 months was that that gave signals to various agents in the German market to producing various goods and allocating capital more efficiently, which actually led to falling prices in basic goods and rising real wages. Is that something that you dispute, or were you sort of thinking about a broader picture over a much longer period of time?
It's not me who disputes it, it's the economic historians. So remember a couple of things. First of all, the Germans didn't have any printing presses for the money, because they were in Berlin. The money actually had to be printed in the United States. The United States was primarily responsible for it. Erhard didn't lift the full controls across the range of goods. And the argument of the economic historians was that it wasn't a direct implementation of that ordo-liberal view with a releasing of price controls. It's a shock therapy for a few months, and then you start to get the Wirtschaftswunder. It's much more complicated than that. And you can also point to events later. I mean, the famous example that all the economic historians talk about is the contest between Adenauer and the Bundesbank in 1957 over pension reform. So Adenauer's pension reforms was completely contrary to ordo-liberal principles. It was pay-as-you-go, inflation-proofed. You know, you don't do that on an ordo-liberal basis. So I just think that there's a lot of mythology around, and I mean, I try and give the references in my chapter, that really needs to be disembodied. Because what those who peddle this mythology say is that to a Keynesian, the German economic miracle is literally miraculous. You know, it couldn't have happened on Keynesian assumptions, but it happened, therefore ordo-liberalism is right. My point is to stress the role of wage restraint by the German trade unions in the late 40s, early 50s as being absolutely key to that, and that is something I get from the economic literature.
Do you not think that the writers in the Ordo Jahr are not looking at a much broader perspective, but looking at a very short period of time, roughly about a year, and they're kind of arguing that without the abolition of price controls, you wouldn't have had that initial boost?
Oh, sure. No, I think I'm perfectly happy with the idea that it's a necessary condition, but I think it's a much more complicated story than that.
Charles Jenkins, a journalist. You talked. Some people of the panel talked about ethics and morality as part of ordo-liberalism. In the context of the Eurozone crisis, there seemed to be an ethic that debt was wrong, the creditors were right, the debtors were wrong, and indeed the German word for debt, Schuld, is the same as guilt, yeah, as guilt. Is that view of debt and credit part of older liberalism, or was it added by Schäuble?
Do you want to go?
Yeah, you go first.
Die schwäbische Hausfrau.
Yeah.
Do you know, I mean, it was, we talked about this a bit at the conference, and we're not 100%, there is certainly no morality in terms of, is there a Protestant morality around the ordo-liberal tradition? In the text I have read, there doesn't seem to be a Protestant morality there. It seems to be more the idea of how do we maintain the price mechanism, and that's where you get the restriction on debt. However, within the volume, we do have an indication of at least a relationship with the Protestant tradition within the ordo-liberal tradition. What is going on now within the German, attitudes to Greece? I think this is a touch more complicated. You certainly, I don't know, others in the room may know this better than I, you certainly may have a Protestant side, but that isn't necessarily the ordo-liberal side. I think the efforts still to impose price conditionality beyond, well, to impose economic conditionality beyond its usefulness, where it no longer works as a definition of why Europe is legitimate in German eyes. Yeah? Europe is legitimate in German eyes because it's only about that order, that framework that doesn't impinge on the politics or the sovereignty of the nation, this sort of in constitutional terms. And it's clearly outlived its usefulness, but if you admit that it's outlived its usefulness, you also undermine the legitimacy of the relationship of the German constitution to the European order. I mean, that's a legal response. My colleagues may have better responses in those terms.
I think that if you look at this book, right, Eucken's Grundsätze, that you won't find a lot of explicit moralizing in there, but I think you will find a lot of implicit moralizing. So what he says about inflation, for instance, why does inflation upset him? Among other things, because it allocates rewards in ways that don't correspond to skillful economic leadership. For instance, it allows people to pay off debts with inflated currency. Now, that's really interesting. Skillful performance might be to say, hey, there's going to be inflation, I'll take on debt and then I'll pay it off in cheaper things. So that is an implicit argument that debt is morally legitimate. If you read that book, you're not going to find a lot about budget deficits and international macroeconomics, etc. But I do think that there is a general feeling that about matching responsibility to consequences for behavior that is implicitly fairly deeply moralized, and I do think has some genealogical relationship to the kinds of attitudes around debt that we saw in the course of the Eurozone crisis.
Yeah, I mean, I gave that quotation from Jens Weidmann, really, that was, in a sense, an expression of that view, that just as households in an economy had to be responsible for their finances, so countries in a currency union had to be responsible for theirs. Something we haven't really touched on, but that may be relevant in this context, is that at least in Eucken, he is really disturbed by unconstrained power.
Yes.
And so, for example, one thing that's very important for him was a Rice Court judgment of 1897, which allowed cartels to be legal. And his argument is that there are two principles which come into conflict. The competition principle, which disperses power and so reduces the concentration of power, and a freedom of contract principle, which allows people to contract together to acquire power. So I think a lot of this stress on responsibility is about the dispersal of power among economic agents who are going to be constrained by competition. That's why it's important that people take the consequences of the economic calculations that they enter into.
I think maybe one might also say at a general level, I mean, to the extent to which there are moral precepts in any theory, it remains an open question onto which units one maps those concerns in any particular moment. So that states should become the units of responsibility, those actors that one might want to moralize rather than other types of agents and other types of social relation. I think that's something which is never going to be wholly anticipated in a theory that's conceived in a quite different setting. So the even if there is a link, there is a moral tendency within a theory, nothing within it will determine how it is applied onto units quite different from those in which it was conceived.
I mean, I had for a long time a problem with this whole fascination with all the liberalism. And in Germany, it doesn't make sense to me because the Germans are, if anything, the Germans are then the greatest hypocrites on the planet because obviously Germany does industrial policy. It's a deeply corporatist country. If we are all the liberals in Germany, then I wonder how one can explain that. But actually, I have to say your book and some of your contributions actually explained something to me, and I really liked how David Woodruff started with, they had a similar problem or question as Polanyi had, namely, why did classical liberalism fail? And in a way, they went in very different directions. I mean, Edgar Salin, for example, had a major attack on Erhard for the currency reform and asked for a welfare state compensation for all the workers that lose savings and through prices lose their purchasing power and so on and so forth. But and then finally, Jonathan, with this explanation that actually what they... that why the meaning of liberalism, that they reject political agency and are in that sense an anti-populist force. That sense that one should rely on rules, of course, has different meanings in different times. In the EU, the rules also protect the smaller ones, just because the Germans constantly insist on rules when they suit themselves. Doesn't mean that rules are always in favor of the powerful. These rules also protect the weaker ones. And therefore, I find it problematic to say or to not see that context in which they insisted so much on rules and not on the overpowering state. Because above all, I think they are what Jonathan indicated. They were elites that feared in fascism not only this interventionism, the state, but also this mass movement that is totally out of control and where Keynesianism, for example, is something that promises a state responsibility for living standards and so on, which they think if you then can't guarantee, basically, they take on to the streets and that's the agency that they feared. But it means to me, you know, being an unreconstructed Keynesian, in a different time, things just work out differently. That's why order liberalism can then be assimilated completely and doesn't constrain almost any policy that Germany has done in the post-war years. And that is my last comment. I think Germany was a very Keynesian country, actually. The only thing that it did differently from Keynes was that it wanted to get the demand side from the rest of the world, exports that stimulated its economy. But otherwise, it was very much a Keynesian policy and a very smart one for that.
Thank you.
I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I think in a way the Ordo Liberal prescriptions worked precisely by under conditions that the Ordo Liberals thought they would make them not work. The corporatism, the particular Rhineland style of capitalism that Germany developed. I mean, the one thing I would say about rules, and this goes back to some work, I mean, I first became interested in this Anglo-German comparison when I started working on environmental policy in the 1980s. And the Brits were constantly complaining about the Germans. The trouble with the Germans is they wanted uniform emission standards, which was completely ridiculous because we all knew if you applied the same rule in different circumstances, it turned out to be a mess. And what you needed was British flexibility. And so on. And exactly the same tropes get played out in the Euro debate these days.
This one.
Knowing very little about this subject, but could I ask how influential do you think ordo-liberalism is likely to be on the way the EU is run in the future?
Well, I'll start as the one who of these folks who knows the least about this question. What I would say is that the character of ordo-liberalism's influence is subtle but very important, and it has to do with the style of governance that ordo-liberals promote. Ordo-liberalism says we ought to have rules that are exceptionalist, that work automatically, that don't lead to crises, that prevent crises. Now and again, we're going to get crises. What are we going to do with them? This is Jonathan's question. Part of what we're going to do with them is react in circumstances, but we're also going to try to redesign the rules in ways that we'll never have to do this again. So an instance often cited of German hypocrisy around the Eurozone crisis is, well, they had a lot of bank bailouts in the aftermath of the crisis of 2008. They did, and some of that was financed by the lender governments. But at the same time they were doing that, they also instituted the what's called the debt brake, which was then the model for the fiscal compact and so on, that said you can't use as much deficit spending as is necessary. In other words, they tried to say, here we're going to do the discretion, but we're also going to get a new rule that means that we'll never have to do this discretion again. I think that style of governance, the ambition to come up with a net of rules such that there would never have to be exceptions to them, has been an influence throughout the reaction to the Eurozone crisis and in Eurozone governance, EU governance more generally. So that isn't something you read in Eucken, but I think that it is a descendant of their project of ensuring governability.
Maybe just one addition. I mean, clearly there's much to be said on what one wants to treat as court-order liberalism and what is a contingent feature of it in a certain historical situation. One of the chapters, I think, in this book wants to make the argument, and it's not by one of us, wants to make the argument that actually one of the constitutive features of ordo-liberalism is a project of constraining democratic impulses for, of course, entirely understandable, perhaps even admirable reasons in the context in which it was being formulated. So here, and it comes back to some of the things I was saying about constraint of political agency, not just for economic reasons of coherent policy making, but also for preventing state capture by private actors and potentially a kind of a loss of the autonomy of the state in that process. If that is, and if democratic impulses are part of that danger which is to be warned off, if that is what one understands as core to order liberalism, and to some extent then some of the economic aspects of it are ways of following through on that thought, following through on what is ultimately a political concern and actualizing it in a certain context, well, then you might say that however much the economics of today's European Union may be in some ways quite different from orthodox order liberal economic thought, and here one might talk about the place of European Central Bank and reliance on the discretionary input of central bankers and so on. So what all of the extent in which it marks a departure economically from certain core ideas of order liberalism in the 1930s, 1940s, nonetheless there might be continuities in the political project of limiting the susceptibility of political institutions to some type of takeover by currents emerging from society. In this particular age, we might talk of those with the name populism. So I think one doesn't have to necessarily answer your question in terms of the continuities of economic policy making in today's EU, yesterday's EU, and its continuities with order liberal thought in earlier generations. It may be that the continuities and perhaps the influences are political in focus.
No, I'll wait. I'm not sure if you're asking the right question in the sense of do ordo-liberals exist in Europe or the European institutions? I mean, that is is this ordo-liberalism that we're seeing? I'm not sure that Germany is ordo-liberal anymore. I'm not sure it's got that side to it. But does ordo-liberalism have a future? Will it play a role in the future? I think in terms of the crisis in economic liberalism and the response, as you've said as well, the response to our economic liberal models are falling to pieces, full stop, either because they have become technocratic, wholly technocratic, scientism in that pejorative sense, where there is no market freedom because we promise we can control everything, or because they have been blown away by free marketeers who destroy markets. And Albert's point about ordo-liberalism may be helping us reconstruct a liberal model in terms of its core message, its core theoretical starting message, is a market can only be a market if everyone is powerless. And that, that might be the normative stroke political input for the future. Practically, the real expressions of ordo-liberalism within the European order, and it was certainly around competition policy, yeah, those practical expressions of ordo-liberalism disappeared not very long time ago, but in the late 1990s as competition policy fell to an efficiency model. So maybe we're looking in the wrong places, that it might come back in that area.
So there's a certain irony in this. So if you look at Sara Wagenknecht's book, Freedom versus Capitalism, the leader of the Die Linke, she actually has a passage in praise of the ordo-liberals because they are taking on the power of large capitalist enterprises. Now, this may be just a sort of rhetorical trick, that she's pulling, but, I mean, it's interesting that she could do that. Slightly facetious answer to your question, I think, is that it really does depend on whether Jens Weidmann becomes the next president of the Bundesbank after Mario Draghi. I mean, it's clear that he has thought that quantitative easing is monetizing government debt, and that's contrary to the principles of a sound economic constitution. And I think it's also worth remembering that, to the extent to which ordo-liberal currents of thought were around the Bundesbank was always sceptical of monetary union preceding political union. And that's a very distinctly ordo-liberal message. You need to have the framework of law and the constitution in place before you can put the economic policy in place.
Please. I have a related question. I mean, I think the title of the lecture was Auto-Liberalism, Solution for the European Crisis. Again, this is very German-focused. How do you create
or get an economic constitution or rules. Not, it's not just Germany. It's beyond that. It's the borders. And that's how do you see or what elements of this the theory or the history? I realize it's very fluid, and yes, you adapt to the crisis, which is great, but truthfully, at some point in time, you have to create, you know, something or you come up with new rules, and truthfully, the rules that are now floating around, I think we're just in another crisis.
Okay. So I'm talking about, that's a very interesting question, and I think it's worth remembering the plurality of economic theories and philosophies that have existed in Europe. So if you move outside of, say, United Kingdom Keynesianism, German ordo-liberalism, you've got a very strong Italian tradition of federalism. For example, you've got the French planning tradition. You've got the sort of Scandinavian proto-Keynesianism, which is then morphed subsequently. So I do think it's a challenge for the economic constitution of Europe to think about how you bring together these public philosophies of economic management in a meaningful way.
Thank you very much. My name is Kira Gardzo from the European Institute. As an outsider to the subject and perhaps suffering from the affliction that Jonathan described at the start, I just wanted to ask you, according to the argument in the book, how widespread or what is the incidence, the extent of the prevalence of the ordo-liberal ideology among German elites? And what is the mechanism of reproduction of the of ordo-liberal framework? So is it something that goes through socialization at the elite level, or is it something that also affects voters and kind of gets recycled through the electoral process?
Well, I think you've put your finger on one of the debates in the book and one of the major disagreements within it. I think maybe one way of thinking about it, which I think many of those part of this project gravitated towards, at least by the end of the process, was that as a doctrine in universities, as a economic doctrine, and also as a self-understanding of scholars and influential policymakers, ordo-liberalism is not alive, current either in Germany or the European Union, but as a reference point, as a way of making certain policies somehow tessellate with commonsensical ideas or ideas which are embedded at a much deeper level than at a certain the level of theoretical propositions, but are somehow in cultural assumptions, that there is a enduring residue, and I use words like sensibility to capture this, and also, I mean, not just in populations for whom justifications of policy might be targeted, but also in the self-understanding of decision makers, officials, those who might want to pepper speeches with references to an ordo-liberal tradition as a way of giving a certain context and plausibility to policy making, which is perhaps in no sense determined by the doctrines themselves. So I think that's one of the divisions in the book, but that's one way perhaps of thinking about it. Alive as a language of justification and as a way of linking policies to intuitions, more perhaps than as a doctrine yielding particular policy proposals.
Okay, we have time for one last question.
Yes, hi. I'd like to add a sort of like more global perspective on ordo-liberalism. Like I noted the mention about the fact that the D-Linker politician made mention that ordo-liberalism could be a means with which states could actually contest the sort of like policy influence of big corporations. But in IR now, there's a tendency to argue that big MNCs are increasingly starting to exercise independent power of their own beyond the nation state. So if that's the case, considering that many nation states have been reluctant to impose regulations on big corporations on grounds that they fear capital flight, etc., to what extent do you think this idea of ordo-liberalism is relevant in a future where the world is going to get more globalized and MNCs may start to exercise more transnational power? Thank you.
I'll say one thing about that. I think it's an excellent question. I think it bears remembering that the key ideas of this doctrine were worked out in a period when the world was deglobalizing and when the nation state, for good or for ill, appeared to be the fulcrum of what politics was about. And so they're thinking, the foundational texts are thinking about what should the policy of a nation state be, at least the bits of it that I've read, and less about how would you deal with actors that have a transnational footprint.
Within the WTO discussion, at least until a few years ago, you'd have someone like Petersmann, the global competition law. And it was an ordo-liberal global competition law that they were thinking of. There was actually that that desire amongst the groups. So, and also, if you think about the new technologies and who controls the nodes and in networking and this, that, and the other, and I do wonder if that. I mean, part of me is with you and saying, oh, God, how can they possibly think about controlling global economic power within an ordo-liberal framework? But I do wonder if that might not reemerge, that might not reemerge in terms of let's develop the global competition law that is power control rather than efficiency. But whether it'll work...
there might be some principles. I mean, I think David's right. I mean, they were in a very different world, but there might be some interesting principles that you might think about. So I think it is pretty central to ordo-liberalism that you don't allow credit creation independently of the ability to produce wealth.
Yeah.
So if banks become too big to fail, then they are too big. And I think that's one of the things that ordo-liberals would be very worried about. So Bitcoin is very worrying from an ordo-liberal point of view, but any build-up of debt-financed activity is worrying from an ordo-liberal point of view.
Okay, so I think we've run out of time, but I'd like to ask you to join me in thanking the speakers for sharing their very interesting ideas with us, and the book is just out, Ordo-Liberalism, Law, and Rule of Economics.